cause that would put its leader again firmly on the side of the angels. A World's Fair was, moreover, no local event. It was big news nationally, to some extent all over the Western world. That was no small consideration to a man to whom fame was a spur. Moses' fame had been in general limited to New York and nearby states. His sips of national fame had been few and far between. Here was a chance to get himself a real swallow. In his last consideration, he was motivated by a more obscure consideration. He had long seen the parallels between his own career and that of the man who, in the modern world, ranked closest to him as a city builder, Baron George Eugene Haussmann, whom Moses was fond of referring to as the brawny Alsatian, and he knew that it was not the Bois de Boulogne, but the great Universal Exposition held in Paris in 1867 that had given Haussmann his greatest contemporary glory. I think Bob thought the World's Fair would be the crowning achievement of a long career, Paul Scrivain says. Informed of Moses' oblique hints, the mayor got the message. In a series of meetings during the week of August 10th, meetings at which Wagner had a representative, final arrangements were made for Moses to take the fair post. On August 20th, the mayor announced that he was appointing a management consultant, J. Anthony Panuk, to reorganize the city's housing picture. Moses could not take the fair post until the legislature approved a law he had drafted exempting officers of the Fair Corporation from the city's code of ethics. And the legislature did not meet until January, and so Panuk had to keep studying the situation for months. When opposition developed in the legislature, he had to delay his report until it was crushed. On February 20th, with all the details ironed out, Moses wrote Panuk that he wanted to leave the housing field because he was going to be heading the fair. And on March 9th, Panuk issued a report recommending that all agencies involved in the city's housing program, including the Mayor's Committee on Slum Clearance, be combined into a single new agency. And Moses announced that he would resign as committee chairman and as park commissioner, member of the City Planning Commission, and member of the City Youth Board on May 23rd. He recommended that the Office of City Construction Coordinator, which he said was no longer necessary, be abolished. Official liaison with the state and federal highway agencies should be carried on by the chairman of the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority, and the mayor should officially designate him as that representative. Moses' enemies never understood what was going on. They believed that the appointment of Panuk was a desperate move by a mayor determined to force Moses out by reorganization if he couldn't get him out in any other way. Haddad and Kahn called the appointment pushing the Panuk button. But the conclusive proof that Moses left voluntarily was the way he did it. He left in triumph. There were the editorials of praise, of course, and the letters. Wagner's said, "For well over a quarter of a century in city service, and for nearly 40 years in state service, you have come closer to being the irreplaceable man than any other in the history of our city government. Our consolation in your leaving lies in the fact that we have had you so long. The city will long remember your work in its behalf. You helped give to our city excitement and color, as well as concrete highways. Your severest critics of yesterday will say in years to come, 'He may have been a headache, but he never was a bore.' I, for myself, would rather quote the title of that song. Thanks for the memory." An even more revealing index of the depth of that triumph was the crowd in the grand ballroom of the Hotel Commodore on May 3rd, and the identity of the people who made up that crowd. In April, business, political, and union leaders, a cross-section of the elite among New York's power establishment, had received invitations to a testimonial banquet, proceeds to charity, in honor of Robert Moses. The price for the tickets was $100 a plate, and the invitations had been sent not to corporations, which might purchase whole tables and give away the tickets, but to individuals who would have to bear the cost of their loyalty themselves. Moreover, they would, if they bought tickets, be honoring an individual who had for months, almost a year in fact, been linked by headlines with scandal. Yet the invitations bore the names of a sponsoring committee that included not only Tom Shanahan, Carmine DiSapio, and Sidney Barron, but a score of other prominent politicians, businessmen, and union leaders. None of them had asked for anonymity. Not one of them was in any way ashamed to be connected with a ceremony honoring the headline's target. In fact, they were proud of it. Many of them asked Shanahan for a chance to speak. And no one invited wanted to be left out, no matter what other plans the recipients of the invitations may have had for the evening, and most of these men had schedules booked far longer in advance than the 3 weeks before the dinner, they dropped those plans and came. Expecting a normal number of turndowns, the committee was astonished to find that all but a handful of invitations had been accepted. On the evening of May 3rd, the Commodore Ballroom was jammed to the doors with 1,044 guests. More than 1,000 persons had been willing, eager, to pay $100 for the privilege of honoring a man whom the press had been attacking mercilessly for months. And when, speaker after speaker having praised him, Robert Moses arose to accept a gift of gold cufflinks from Shanahan, those men jumped to their feet and cheered. Sid Shapiro says he will never forget that moment. "Everybody was there," he says. "Everybody. And you should have seen them. They were standing there applauding and yelling like a bunch of schoolboys." And the men standing and yelling for Shapiro's idolized RM were the men RM would have wanted standing and yelling for him, not the establishment of the political, banking, union, and construction fields in which he moved, but the elite of that establishment, the creme de la creme of New York's influentials. And more important than leaving in triumph, he left with power. Wagner announced that Newbold Morris would be Moses' successor as park commissioner, the second citywide park commissioner in the city's history. The press hailed Morris, or to be more precise, Morris's image, which, created in the LaGuardia era, had been that of a young, independent reformer. But it wasn't his independence that had gotten Morris, now 58, still good-hearted but bumbling, ineffectual, and so nervous that rumors were adrift about his drinking habits, and very anxious indeed to return to city employment, the job. Rather, the qualification was his awe, a hero worship that amounted to utter subservience, of Robert Moses. A subject of City Hall jokes, even in the LaGuardia days, those feelings had dimmed not at all, as some spectators at the dedication in 1963 of a bust of Fiorello LaGuardia at LaGuardia Airport would see. Recalls Henry Barnes, "Morris made a speech, and at the end of it he gave an Italian phrase which he had obviously studied very hard to get just right. Moses was the next speaker. He got up and said, 'I had no idea that Newbold was smart enough to speak Italian.' And then he starts off into a whole run of Italian, very fluent, shrugging his shoulders and everything, just deliberately to humiliate Newbold like that. And Newbold wasn't in too good shape at the time. It was just vicious." But what astounded Barnes was that after the ceremony, Morris came up to Moses and tried to talk to him, just groveling for a word from the master. At his swearing-in as park commissioner, which Moses did not bother to attend, he called his predecessor a giant in public works who will be remembered long after we are gone. With almost the entire park department hierarchy of Moses' men left intact under him, Morris was park commissioner only in name. Robert Moses was still running the department exactly as he had run it before, as anyone having much business with the department soon found out. Whenever Joe Ingraham called Morris in the evening with a question, the new commissioner would, no matter what the subject, say, "I want to think about it. I'll call you back in a few minutes." Ingraham would wait a minute or two and then telephone Moses' private number. Almost invariably that number would be busy, and when Morris called back, he would give Ingraham a statement that Moses' old reporter confidant could tell came directly from Moses, as verbatim as if the new commissioner had copied down and repeated what the old commissioner had told him to say, word for word. "He just wouldn't move unless Bob Moses told him to move, and when," Barnes says. I argued with him one time about something, and he said, "Well, Bob Moses feels this way about it." I said, "Who's the park commissioner?" He said, "Well, Bob Moses built the parks." Once he dared to make a statement on his own, and accepted, almost eagerly, a public spanking. He said that unless Westchester County stopped barring New Yorkers from its parks, the city might have to obtain entrance for its residents by legislative fiat. Upon reading his successor's quote, Moses said, "I am afraid Newbold was a bit impulsive. His demand that all parks everywhere must be open to everybody has a superficial charm which won't stand analysis." Reporters telephoned Morris for a comment, which was, "Mr. Moses is absolutely correct. I am impulsive." As Scrivain says, by naming Morris as Moses' successor, Wagner knew he was keeping the department in Moses' hands. At first, reporters, not understanding the conditions under which Moses was resigning his city jobs, assumed that Moses was losing his power over roads. But soon, Ed Catcher of the Post was writing that Commissioner Moses, New York's longest-running municipal feature, is not, after all, vanishing entirely from the local administrative scene. He will continue to represent the city on the federal and state arterial highway programs. On the day he resigned, Peter Keis of the Times took the trouble to do a little figuring of the cost of the arterial program and such other Moses projects underway as the Verrazano and Throgs Neck bridges and the Niagara Power, Park, and Parkway project, and wrote that a rough check indicated that Mr. Moses still retained other jobs by which he was presiding over $2,800,000,000 in projects to make over the city and state. The only power Moses lost by his multiple resignations was in housing, a power he was glad to give up anyway. In parks and roads, he was still in charge. And to replace the power he had lost in housing, he had been given command of a new project loaded with power. He left in triumph because he wasn't really leaving at all. Furthermore, no one could ever make him leave. Thanks to his control of one city and three state public authorities, he had anchored himself in a position so secure that no one could take his power away from him. Only he could lose it for himself. His career, booming to new heights in the eighth decade of his life, could be checked only by his own personality. Only Robert Moses could lose Robert Moses his power. And he did.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.